Tim, we feel welcomed to Wisconsin. Thank you. I have to make one further announcement, and that is that our schedule has changed. Tropical Storm Tammy has disrupted air travel on the East Coast. And unfortunately, Steve Moore has been unable to get a plane out of Washington to Milwaukee, in spite of spending several hours at Reagan National Airport. The good news, though, is that I am delighted to tell you that Bill Campbell has agreed to step in and provide some context and introductory thoughts to prepare us for tomorrow's meeting. As many of you know, Bill Campbell is the secretary of the Philadelphia Society, a charter member, and he is truly our heart and soul. So, Bill, would you come on up and get us ready for tomorrow?
Thank you very much, Vic. It's a delight to be here. I'm not Steve Moore, but I'll try to put the reasons why we chose Milwaukee into context. And Tim has already introduced this topic in a magnificent way. And as he points out, there are pluses and minuses of being in Milwaukee, the center of progressivism. But the one thing he didn't read that I thought he was going to read to you was a 1959 meeting of the the Wisconsin Conservative Club, called a Symposium on Conservatism. And it might be worthwhile just to read the list of names. I won't read the topics, but the list of names of the people who were at this, presumably, a one-day symposium. Richard Weaver, Ludwig von Mises, William Henry Chamberlain, Wilmore Kendall, Anthony Buscarin, E. Merrill Root, Albert Hobbs, and Russell Kirk. Now that is a one-day seminar of some weight and eminence, just absolutely magnificent. Thank you, Tim, for this. And you can explore this later on. He'll have it outside, but we make sure you don't have your chocolate with you when you take a look at it. One of our distinguished members, Forrest MacDonald, one of his first works that he ever wrote was A History of the Electrical Industry in Wisconsin, 1957. The title was Let There Be Light. So we will try to provide some light on this subject. Now, for the people in Wisconsin and probably with his department, they chose to regard him as a tool of the Power Trust for writing this history of the electrical industry in Wisconsin. He was interviewed by Brian Lamb on television, and Lamb says, I've got to tell you, I was having lunch the other day close by, and the fellow sitting next to me turns out to be an historian. Somehow we started talking about this show, and I said, I had your book. He said, Forrest MacDonald's an old friend of mine. But this is what he said. Oh, you know he's very conservative. He's been beat up over the years by the liberal professors in this business. He wanted me to ask you about that. Then he said, ask him about the Wisconsin Historical Society. MacDonald replied, I know who you're talking about because I just saw him a little while ago. And he mentioned this. I met him, this man, in the 1950s. When he was out there at the State Historical Society of Wisconsin to be interviewed for a job. The history department at the University of Wisconsin had the old progressive La Follette kind of a tradition, and they weren't leftists, but they were all very much on the liberal extreme of the spectrum. That's very interesting, because most of us who are in college in the 50s and 60s would not have described our professors as leftists. They would have been liberals in some sense, but not that hardcore sort of radical revolutionary leftist that we associate today. but he says they were all very much on the liberal extreme of the spectrum. To historians of that sort, the name of Charles Beard was a sacred one. Charles A. Beard was a historian who wrote a book many years ago called An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. He might have even tried to link it up, and this is not Forrest, but me, with the ownership society, that all these men were the founders of the Constitution, were owners of private property, and solely tried to defend their private property rights in terms of writing the Constitution. McDonald goes on to say, it just angered conservatives everywhere, because what he said essentially was that the Constitution was written by a bunch of people who had certain kinds of economic interests, and they wrote the Constitution to protect those interests. My doctoral dissertation, Forrest talking here, which later got turned into a book called We the People, absolutely demolished the Beard interpretation. And I say that not boastfully. Every reviewer agreed that it did. And you know, I was a young whippersnapper. The folks at Wisconsin didn't like me for that. And they did an awful lot of bad-mouthing of me and some smearing and such stuff as that. I've got no complaints. I had a wonderful career, but I've run into some, well, political correctness was not invented in the last 5 years. That's very true. Now, the topic of the ownership society. Obviously, we know part of it as a slogan put forward by President Bush to organize his domestic agenda. The intent is to return decision-making to the families and individuals. Under this rubric, tax reform, Social Security reform, welfare reform, and educational reform are all parts of the agenda of Bush and the conservative movement. The purpose is to promote the responsibility of individuals for their decisions. Now, there are legitimate differences between conservatives and libertarians as to how far the current administration and Congress should go and how far they have gone in implementing these ideals. But no matter what gets sacrificed on the altar of political expediency or political ineptness in the case of Congress, the clarification of the ideals and the long-term changes required in the American body politics has long been a concern of the members of the Philadelphia Society. Order and liberty means limited constitutional government. Now, Tim mentioned that he'd originally, I don't think he pointed this out, but he had a button, let's sing and dance the New Deal away. And it was that kind of a spirit that inspired this meeting. Now, the New Deal was the culmination of the progressive movement, which initiated the era of big government. President Clinton prematurely said it was over. But of course, he qualified his statement with, we can't go back to a time when our citizens were just left to fend for themselves. Now, conservatives differ on how far to turn back the clock, but they are agreed that there are many institutions between the individual self and the federal government who should take the major responsibility for the many functions of the federal government. I had written that before Hurricane Katrina, and being from Louisiana, those words came very much home to me, of course, because the first lines of defense of the communities, the cities, the states were totally wiped out in the case of the response to Hurricane Katrina. It's remarkable the difference between what happened in New Orleans and the kind of coverage that it got, and what happened with Hurricane Rita, which primarily affected the Cajuns in the western part of the state. You didn't see pictures of them. You didn't see reports about them, primarily because many of them, of course, have always been opposed to government intervention in their lives and affairs for many years and maintained that tradition. So this is something that we can talk about as this weekend progresses, as the practical implications of the response and what should be the response to these terrible hurricanes that have hit us. Fortunately, I live in Baton Rouge, and we were not as directly affected. We just lost our electricity, many trees, but very little damage to homes and to our way of life, except doubling our population there for a while. which got to be a little hairy. Now, what is the essence of the Progressive and New Deal traditions? According to Howard Dickman, a writer on the labor policy during that time, progressivism meant a commitment to the exertion of collective force, typically through the state, on behalf of the majority. To the progressive mind, individual property rights were only a means for the unscrupulous minority to exploit the majority. Again, the reason that Forrest MacDonald had to write his book, We the People. The so-called abstract rights of mankind must be denied if society is ever to become the arbiter of its own destiny. Sort of progressive vision of society and human beings become masters of themselves and masters of the entire world, including the forces of nature. The progressive movement received its intellectual apogee in many ways at the University of Wisconsin under the influence of Christian socialist economists like Richard Ely, John R. Commons, Edwin Witt, and its president from 1903 to 1918, Charles von Hayes. Drawing on the paternalistic and Alan Carlson will help straighten some of this out for us tomorrow, the maternalistic models of Bismarckian Germany, some of these German-trained PhDs were ensconced originally at Johns Hopkins University and subsequently moved west to Wisconsin. Of course, the effect of the PhD on the whole history of American education is another story that needs to be told. Richard Ely, I went to taught economics at LSU for 42 years, and we had a major collection of German historical school pamphlets in our library because we had bought Richard Ely's library. And along with his library came a collection of portraits of the German historical school economists and a big, huge bust of Richard Ely, who's now in our mailroom. His nose was broken off, but we did have that repaired. But they painted him a strange color. I don't know why they did that. So Ely has been on my mind for many a year. Now, fighting Bob La Follette, that Tim referred to, brought the techniques of the administrative state and the role of the intellectuals into conjunction with practical politics. The Wisconsin Experiment, as it was called, was described in a 1912 book, The Wisconsin Idea, by Charles McCarthy. Don't know whether he was related to Joe McCarthy or not. You didn't bring that into your speech, Tim. I thought you might do that. In Theodore Roosevelt's introduction to that book, we had our scholarship orientation here in the hotel. We had our choice between the Roosevelt Room, and I asked the lady, I said, was that named for Theodore Roosevelt or FDR? And she didn't know. So then we had a Kennedy Room. We decided that wouldn't be appropriate. So the Taft Room was as close as we could come to the proper place for the scholarship orientation. But anyway, Roosevelt gives thanks, quote, to the movement for genuinely democratic popular government, which Senator La Follette led to overwhelming victory in Wisconsin. And he argued that Wisconsin has become a laboratory, we've heard this language before, a laboratory for wise experimental legislation aiming to secure the social and political betterment of the people as a whole. Now, some experiments are failures, and that's one of the things we learn from the experimental method, but that's very seldom happens in government, even though the states are supposed to be the laboratories for the United States. Now, McCarthy went to point out that Germany, as the source of what Americans need to know to overcome its materialistic bent, and this is a very strong strand, of course, within the progressive tradition. He says, our civilization with its wealth and prosperity must be made to exist for its true purposes, the betterment, the efficiency, and the welfare of each individual. The Germans have shown us the way. We need not adopt all their methods, but we will do well to accept their philosophy, for there is no patent on it. America must cope with this new devastating influence of wealth sanely and successfully, so that greater prosperity and more equitable distribution of its benefits under just laws will result. So efficiency is one of the key words for the progressive tradition. It's always a not economic efficiency defined in terms of Pareto optimality, but it's a kind of bureaucratic administrative concept of efficiency which is going to characterize the activities of the state. McCarthy touted such great presidents of the University of Wisconsin as John Bascom and Charles Van Hise. At great length, he describes the German training of Richard Ely. He points out that the same philosophy which was being taught in the University of Wisconsin was slowly becoming the dominating influence in Germany. The strength of this theory in remote times is clearly shown in the writings of early German economists. The belief that it pays the state to concern itself in the betterment of human beings and the protection of human welfare in order that it may receive in return a rich reward from this investment is not a new one. So even though we are choosing to go back to the New Deal, which we'll hear about tomorrow, and progressivism, which we will hear about tomorrow, it goes back a long way into German intellectual history. Now, Teddy Roosevelt, in his progressive run for president in 1912, hit the main themes of the welfare state, which will be picked up by his distant cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, in his arguments for the New Deal. Roosevelt in 1912 argued the protection of home life against the hazards of sickness, irregular employment, and old age through a system of social insurance adopted to American use. The call for national community provided the national bully pulpit for government-provided security attended to by experts and bureaucrats. This welfare state was to be run by the administrative experts. The themes of science, efficiency, and expert knowledge are all devices by which the messy real world of practical politics was to be replaced by public administration. Alonzo Hamby also recognized that the later maturing of the administrative state was born in this progressive era. He pointed out that a major link between the two movements, faith and expertise and bureaucratic management, had been a major theme of modernization in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, not limited to progressives, but enthusiastically adopted by them in manifold ways that ranged from Tom Johnson's professionalization of municipal services in Cleveland to Robert La Follette Sr.'s array of advisory and regulatory commissions in Wisconsin, to federal programs that included conservation, tariff adjustments, transportation regulation, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Reserve System. On the state level, La Follette continued this progressive tradition into the 1930s. Fighting Bob's influence was continued by his sons, Young Bob and Phil. They were both prominent in Wisconsin politics. Phil won three terms as governor in 1930, 1934, and 1936, during which time he passed substantial social welfare legislation, including relief and old age pensions, which served as a model for the Social Security Act of FDR in 1935. Paul A. and Elizabeth Brandeis Rauschenbusch were a husband and wife team of economists whose individual and joint careers exemplified the Wisconsin idea. They are best known for their work with Harold Groves in 1930 to 1932 in developing and securing the passage of Wisconsin's unemployment compensation legislation, the first legislation in the nation. During this period, the couple was also involved with similar legislation in Massachusetts and in crafting the unemployment sections of the 1935 Social Security Act. The state of Wisconsin also provided other links, both theoretical and bureaucratic, to the New Deal itself. The continuities between the progressive movement and the New Deal extend even to the personnel of the two movements. Quote, New Deal concern with social welfare likewise had strong roots in the progressive era. The Social Security Act of 1935 was developed by a committee and advisory council with several members who had direct ties to the social work settlement house wing of progressivism: Perkins, Hopkins, Paul Kellogg, Father John Ryan. Its executive director, Edwin Witt, a University of Wisconsin economist, was a member of probably the most socially engaged economics department of the early 20th century. Now, another thing we're going to hear about tomorrow is environmentalism. Tom Bray is going to report to us some rather interesting favorable things in terms of the relationship between environmental activities and philanthropic activities. But Wisconsin's progressivism from its earliest days to the present has nurtured, in general, a style of environmentalism hostile to private property rights. The scientific mind applied to natural resources stemmed from the German tradition of mercantilism, which was called Cameralism. Cameralism was an attempt prior to Adam Smith to think of the economy, again, in bureaucratic administrative terms. This public administration approach to economic matters got right down to the specific of things like managing the forest. But Wisconsin has been able to combine both the scientific approach of the conservationists and the more mystical approach of the preservationists in its long traditions of progressivism. It is worth noting that Charles Van Hise, the president of the University of Wisconsin, most known for his work in geology, delivered an address upon the occasion of the unveiling of a bronze bust of John Muir in 1916. Although John Muir was born in Scotland, he was raised in Wisconsin. Now, Tom is going to be talking tomorrow about the more positive aspects of the preservationist approach to ecology, continued by Aldo Leopold, who in 1949 introduced America to a Sand County Almanac. And we'll see that there are some very strong vestiges of that remaining in Wisconsin, which have seen the light and gone toward a much more sort of private property approach to maintaining environmental sanity. But as Tim reminded us, he stole a number of things from what I was going to say, the progressive tradition in environmentalism was continued in more recent Wisconsin history. Senator Gaylord Nelson received in 1995 the nation's highest civilian award, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. According to the proclamation from President Clinton, quote, as the father of Earth Day, he is the grandfather of all that grew out of that event, the Environmental Protection Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. Where were they in New Orleans when we needed them? In 1992, the United Nations Environmental Program presented Gaylord Nelson with the only One World Award. And in 1990, he received the Ansel Adams Conservation Award, bestowed upon a federal official who has shown exceptional commitment to the cause of conservation and the fostering of an American land ethic. Well, that's history. That's the influence of the progressive movement in Wisconsin and how strong it was. Is Wisconsin still important in the battle of ideas? The progressive website puts the historical tradition in perspective, but underestimates the radical nature of the conservative vision. According to the progressive website, Wisconsin has a great history of progressive political action, and that history continues right up to the present day. However, they say, the national Republican elite has targeted Wisconsin as a place where they will attempt to take back the social progress of the last five decades, to enact a reactionary agenda to restrict the freedoms that the people of Wisconsin have fought to bring to all of America. More than ever before, Wisconsin progressives need to band together to stand up for freedom against the forces of fear. End quote. At the present time, Russ Feingold and Herb Kohl, the Democratic senators from Wisconsin, both proudly affirm and vote for the progressive tradition. Feingold was elected to the Senate in 1992 and is being talked about, at least in Wisconsin, as a possible presidential candidate. But let's set the record straight. If the left fears assaulting the social progress of the last five decades, think of that now, that's 50 years, that'd be 1955, Okay. They think we're just going back to something a little bit prior to 1955. Then they should try, our reactionary intent is to go back 10 decades, or maybe even 20 decades, if you go back to the thought of Hegel and the German progressive historical movements in the 19th century. But as conservatives know, there are no permanent victories in the wars of ideas. Although the title of E.J. Dionne's 1996 book, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era, does not appear to be true, at least so far. Depends on how one defines an era. But one is reminded of the movie called The Night of the Living Dead. They keep coming back. One should never underestimate the ability of Republicans to overthrow their own conservative mandates. And there will be a lot of discussion of that topic in this meeting. But for this reason, it is important that conservatives continue to stress first principles and fundamentals for all political parties alike. The Philadelphia Society is devoted to the purpose of clarifying these ideas of ordered liberty and the way in which the ownership society can fit into that. So I thank you for your attention, and we will dismiss you at this point. Tomorrow we will start at 8:30. No breakfast is provided, so if you are a breakfast eater, make sure that you get properly taken care of before you get there. But we'll see you at 8:30. We'll have a cash bar in the same area in which we met earlier, and we can continue the conversation there. Thank you so much.